Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Plenary 4 from the 2024 UNAC Conference, held April 5th through the 7th in St. Paul, Minnesota. The plenary is entitled Defending Our Movement, Confronting Repression. UNAC is the United National Anti-War Coalition. UNAC fights against wars at home and abroad. Their goal is to bring together organizations and movements representing people in struggle today and unify in collective action against the major perpetrator of war and injustice in the world, the United States government, along with its allies and proxies.
At this point, I'm going to begin my presentation, and I'm going to be introducing the other speakers. But for those of you who do not know me, I'm Mick Kelly, and I was one of the Anti-War 23. It was a group of activists, international solidarity and anti-war folks, trade unionists and others, who on September 24th were raided by the FBI and subsequently subpoenaed to a grand jury. On the morning of September 24th, what happened is this. About 70 agents accompanied by other folks in law enforcement fanned out around the country and began carrying out raids on offices and homes, including my own. And there's some other people in this room who are in the case. There's Meredith Abbey right there. Do you want to stand up, Meredith? Meredith's home was one of the folks raided by the FBI. What, you had a couple dozen agents at your house? Something like that. There's Sarah Martin over here. Sarah was called to a grand jury in Chicago, and they were very serious about putting her in prison, and she stood up to the grand jury. Tom Burke, who's over here, he's on the stage with me. He's another person who was called to the grand jury and successfully resisted. But so what happened at my house on the morning of September 24th was this. I wasn't there. Just wasn't there. I was at work in a kitchen. But at home, my partner was there. And suddenly she heard pounding on the door and the voice, this is the FBI. She wanted to see the warrant, but instead of seeing the warrant, what happened is they used a battering ram to knock down the door, smashed a fish tank, and suddenly the place was full of an FBI SWAT team. And this was repeated in other places around the country. And it was a dramatic set of raids that was designed to put anti-war and international solidarity activists in jail. So if you look at the warrant for my house and the houses of the others, it basically was looking at a case of material support for terrorism. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But material support of terrorism is basically a thought crime. It says that if you stand in solidarity, effective solidarity, with the National Liberation Movement, we will put you in jail. And we will put you in jail for a very long period of time. So the groups mentioned on my warrant were the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and last but not least, Hezbollah. But the thing about this is this, and that is that I think all those are great groups full of great people doing great things. And I'd never made a secret of that point of view. Never made a secret. You could look on the internet. You can see pictures of me with Leila Khaled from the Popular Front. It's not, whatever, it's not hidden. It's not concealed, nothing about it. But what the Effective Death Penalty and Prevention of Terrorism Act does, it makes it a crime to carry out effective solidarity with national liberation movements. And it's very, very important that it be opposed, and it's a very, very serious charge. Typically, and Mel could talk about this more, every count of material support carries 15 years. Typically, those who are charged are convicted, and those who are convicted end up in what's called a control unit once you get to prison. That's basically a prison within a prison, usually for Muslims. And that's just a reality of America today. We were effective in defeating those charges. And actually, quite truthfully, we were never charged. But we were effective in pushing back against those charges. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the lessons of that, because I think they're applicable for other cases. You know, one is that we were absolutely determined to resist. Not one person testified in front of the grand jury. And for those of you, I think most of you know about grand juries, but for those of you who do not, let me say this. If you get to a grand jury and you don't talk, you can be put in prison. It's actually just that simple. It's meant to be coercive. In other words, they can hold you until they decide that, well, you're never going to talk, and at that point they're supposed to let you go. But it's a very serious thing. All 23 of us refused to testify in front of the grand jury. So that resistance and public resistance was actually vital to our success. Number two, we had an approach of relying on the masses of people. I have only 5 minutes left. And by that, I mean we had to go out in a very big way to bring the broadest possible support around our case. And I think we were very effective in that. We held regional conferences. We formed something called the Committee to Stop FBI Repression. Hundreds of people attended those conferences. We got the endorsement or support from trade unions, trade unions representing about 500,000 people. We sent delegations to Congress to push about our case. And every step of the way, we did everything possible to say the democratic rights of those who want to resist imperialism are under attack. We tried to build as big as possible tent to unite as all who can be united to push back against these charges. And I think that was successful. And finally, we had a good legal strategy that was aggressive, that did things like push back, like the Justice Department had my passport, not just mine, others too. We pushed back legally against that. And we pushed back actually at every single point that we could and had an aggressive strategy that was all about defending our rights. Now, our case was linked with a group of others, and this went on for about 8 years. And I'm not going to be able, for the standpoint of time, to recall all of them, but the two key ones in this is Carlos Montes, former leader of the Brown Berets, who was raided in Los Angeles in 2012, and then Rismio Da, who ended up not doing any jail time or a minimal amount, was eventually deported. But in all those cases, I think the fundamental principles are the same. We need to mobilize people, we need to be aggressive, draw people into motion, and have effective legal strategies. So those are the basic points and basic lessons that I wanted to hit on. So that being the case, I'm going to take it to the other speakers, and I'm introducing Dr. Fields. Dr. Fields is a National Central Committee member of the African People's Socialist Party, and the director of the All African People's Party Development and Empowerment Project. So please, give it up for Dr. Fields and listen to this important case.
Uhuru. Don't be afraid. Uhuru. Okay, for those of you who may not know, Uhuru is a Kiswahili word that means freedom. And it's the word that we use in our movement, not only to identify the movement itself, but to greet each other. Because we believe that freedom has to be on the minds of African people and all colonized people and all freedom-loving people 24 hours a day. So the African People's Socialist Party is more than 50 years old, and it's led by our chairman, Omalia Shetela. The theory that leads the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru movement is called African internationalism. This is a theory that explains the world, and it explains the role of African people in this world. As African internationalists, we recognize that capitalism was born as a world economy and that it has its origin in the assault of Africa and in the global trade of African human beings, as well as the ensuing European onslaught on most of the world. For our party and movement, practice is primary. So for more than 5 decades, we've built a variety of organizations, campaigns, and economic institutions and have championed and led around the cause of reparations for African people. We have built a solidarity movement of white people, members of the colonizer nation, who actually fight against colonialism and work in the white community to win the question of unity through reparations. Our party built the first World Tribunal for Reparations to African People in New York in 1982, where the U.S. government was found guilty of committing genocide against African people based on international law and was found to owe us at least $1.2 trillion for labor alone. Our chairman, Omalia Chatella, is a former member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's 82 years old, and he's a political theorist and strategist who has traveled to over 19 countries, building the Black Power struggle throughout Africa, Europe, and the Americas, and establishing solidarity relations with other colonized peoples and their movements. He has driven the establishment of over 50 Black community economic institutions designed to free African people from the colonial mode of production and from welfare slavery. Today, we see that as the struggle of colonized people for liberation and self-determination intensifies, so does the counterinsurgency, or the efforts to repress the leaders, the organizations, and the masses of people who are fighting to be free. And as we organize to deconstruct this global system of colonial domination, we must be serious in our efforts to defend the movement, to push back the colonial state, and to continue to advance the struggle that ultimately is about making sure that the colonized people of the world have access to our land, our labor, and our resources. In June of 2022, I was sent by our party to our headquarters in St. Louis to help coordinate a program developed under the leadership of our deputy chairwoman called the African Doula Project. This project was a part of our party's multifaceted economic development and anti-gentrification project known as the Black Power Blueprint. The African Doula Project itself is a first step towards building an African Women's Center in St. Louis. We in the African Doula Project provided 14 African working class women in the North Side with the training needed to become full spectrum doulas as part of an effort to address the high rates of infant and maternal mortality in the African community in St. Louis. On July 2nd, 2022, while we were in St. Louis, we got word that a man with a military-grade flamethrower set fire to the huge red, black, and green African national flag that was flying high over our Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida. 4 weeks later, around 5 a.m. on July 29th, the morning of our doula training, the U.S. government attacked us with a violent FBI raid on 7 offices and homes of African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru Movement leaders, including the home of our chairman and our deputy chairwoman, Ona Zeneya Chatella, in St. Louis, the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida, and the Uhuru Solidarity Center in St. Louis. Chairman O'Malley, Deputy Chair Ona, and others were handcuffed with assault rifles pointed at them while the FBI used flashbang grenades, drones, battering rams, breaking down doors and windows, and covered up security cameras as they stole property, computers, phones, files, archives, and more. 2 months later, in September of 2022, Change.org removed our Africans Charged Genocide petition that had over 130,000 signatures from people uniting with our call to charge the U.S. government with genocide against African people. On October 31st, 2022, activist Timba Shabanda was arrested while volunteering in our community garden in St. Louis on a bogus charge of making terroristic threats. He was held for at least 2 weeks, being interviewed by the FBI agents before being released. In December of 2022, we received word that indictments and arrests of 4 unindicted co-conspirators were imminent. On January 7, 2023, the church across the street from our chairman, which was under contract by our movement to build a community center, was burnt to the ground. On February 8, 2023, the FBI was slammed in a St. Louis alderman meeting. And the next day, on February the 9th, the State Department announced a $10 million reward for anybody with information that could help their case against us. A few days later, on February 14th, Pinellas County Board of Supervisors revoked funding for Black Power 96 FM radio, a low-power FM radio station that our party has operated for many years. On March 7th, we held a webinar that showed that the U.S. government was actually imposing sanctions against our movement, economic sanctions similar to those that are imposed on foreign countries that are not subservient to U.S. domination. Some of those attacks included Regions Bank closing our movement accounts, closing our credit lines despite having put hundreds of thousands of dollars in those accounts, calling back a mortgage that, you know, we had never been late on. Facebook blocked the ability for our organizers to crowdfund. GoFundMe stole $9,000 from our fund to be able to do a legal defense of our movement, and Stripe temporarily blocked sustaining donations. With the threat of charges for 9 months looming over our head on April 18th, the chairman, Omalia Chatella, and the African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess, and Uhuru Solidarity Member Movement Chair Jesse Neville were indicted on bogus DOJ charges of being Russian agents. Known as the Uhuru 3, the indictment charges Omalia Chatella, Chairman, of our African People's Socialist Party Chairwoman Penny and Comrade Jesse with conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, acting as agents of the Russian government as they face a maximum prison sentence of 15 years on these completely bogus charges. The activities that serve as the basis for these charges include our work to run candidates for local election on a campaign of Black community control of the police and reparations to the African community, and work that we had done to charge the United States government with genocide to the UN. It must be said that the case of Uhuru 3 threatens the future of First Amendment speech protections for everybody, as everything the DOJ accuses our comrades of is supposed to be protected speech, speaking, broadcasting, or printing dissenting opinions. And the DOJ is trying to redefine disinformation, writing in their arguments that legally prohibited disinformation does not necessarily mean information that's not true, only that it may undermine trust in the U.S. sanctions, support for Western democracies, et cetera. So I want to just say that there's a lot more we can say about this case. In the interest of time, I want to tell folks where we are and what we can do. Right now, we have trial that's set to happen in Tampa Federal Court in September 3rd. We're calling everybody all out for the trial in Tampa. If you can make it, this trial is set to be about a month long, starting on September 3rd. If you can make it for a day, if you can make it for 3 days, if you can make it for a week, if you can make it for the entire trial, we're calling on you to come and show your support for the Uhuru 3 there. We also have a table that's set up in the lobby. This is a table of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, white members of our Solidarity Movement who are working in the interest of bringing white people into the leadership of fighting against colonialism. So we want to invite you to go to that table and get more information about this case. And also, you should check out our website, handsoffuhuru.org. There you can donate to our legal defense. You can sign our emergency pledge, sign our online petition, and you can join the coalition that we formed to do the fight back and make sure that our comrades, our chairman, Omalia Shetela, Chairwoman Penny Hess, Chair Jesse Neville, don't see one day in prison. Hands off Uhuru, hands off Africa.
Genuine heroes for standing up. Genuine heroes. Okay. The next speaker, and we have Stop Cop Cities, very, very important struggle. Vivifa Wangaza, who's going to be talking to us today about this important, important battle that's been taking place in Atlanta and beyond. So here she is. Warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, some struggles we defend against by preventing them from arising altogether. When we recognize the fact that we're engaged in a 500-year battle against a military onslaught against humanity, then we never let down our guard. The United States is an ongoing criminal enterprise built with stolen labor on stolen land, and by definition must maintain a military presence and coercive atmosphere in order to exist at all. My father used to say to us during the 1960s when I was young and full of vinegar and knew everything, "What do you think we've been doing all these years?" One of the things that we need to do in order to prevent to engage in prevention is to know our history, to know the history of struggle in this country, to know the history of struggles. Let me hear you say struggles. Yeah. We have a tendency to think that the one we're engaged in or focused on is the only one. But when we understand that We're engaged with an octopus. We understand that there are many struggles going on at the same time, and it's the head of that one octopus with all those arms that is manipulating us all. And unless and until we recognize that fact, we are playing whack-a-mole. We've put out the struggle in Palestine, or sort of kind of put it out in South Africa, but then we look and there's Haiti, there's the Congo, there's someplace else. So we have to deal with the global system of white supremacy and patriarchy, capitalism, in order to dismantle the demon that besieges the planet and humanity. It is only a spoke in the global white supremacist bulwark for white minority global rule. Therefore, if humanity is to survive, then humanity has to destroy its greatest threat. The proposed Atlanta Cop City Uber Police Militarization Training Base and Headquarters is a reincarnation of antebellum South Carolina's Citadel, built in 1842. The Citadel traces its origins to an arsenal constructed by the state of South Carolina to defend white Charlestonians against possible enslaved African uprisings following Denmark Vesey's thwarted rebellion of 1822, which was preceded by Cato's Stono Rebellion in 1739 and the Haitian Revolution in 1791. Now, what does that remind you of? We start talking about, okay, the uprising after George Floyd or the uprising after Mike Brown. It's a progression, brothers and sisters. And until we recognize that it is a progression, and like the cyclical genocide against the Palestinian people or the Haitian people, or the Congolese people, then we will remain preoccupied with the same old cyclical distractions. So it becomes necessary that we not allow ourselves to be trapped in that cycle, and instead that we recognize the phenomenons as they emerge. And they themselves have cycles. And that, as they say today, genocides don't just happen, but there are symptoms and symbols leading up to them. There are symptoms and symbols leading up to rising fascism, to genocide, and to the most extreme oppressive forms of coercion known to humanity. Given our abilities to recognize those phenomena and to respond to them is our ability to, as they say, cut them off at the pass. It is in that practice and with that perspective that we defend our movements and we create the space that is necessary for humanity to evolve to the next level. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that insightful talk. The next speakers we're going to have is on the victory around the Alex Saab case. We're going to be having Roger Harris, Task Force of the Americas, and William Caracallo, of the Bolivarian Circles from Venezuela. So take it away.
Alex Saab is free. It was a victory for Venezuelan sovereignty. It was a victory for the sanctions kill movement, the movement against sanctions, and it was a victory for everybody in this room. So I want to tell you a little bit about the story of how we were successful in freeing Alex Saab. He was a diplomat, and he was imprisoned for bringing humanitarian supplies to Venezuela in free, legal international trade, but in opposition to the illegal U.S. sanctions. Sanctions that are imposed over a third of humanity. Over 40 countries are suffering under sanctions. The most severe, of course, are the Palestinians today. The United States wanted more than anything else to lock up Alex Saab and throw away the key. But they were unsuccessful because of people like you in this room, and I will go through some of the other elements of that success. His legal team had tried unsuccessfully to free him on the grounds that he was a diplomat. As a diplomat, he's protected by the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. Now, such a diplomat is supposed to enjoy absolute immunity from arrest, even in the time of war. But hey, the world's hegemon does not have to follow the rules of order. They make the rules of order, and they said, no, we don't, even though we are a signatory of the Vienna Convention, we are not going to honor it. Not only that, but this legal team said that he should be freed, yet the United States said, look, we don't even recognize the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro, so why should we recognize his diplomats? So at that point, it looked very bad. But we knew that an international movement, a national movement, and other elements would free him. And we'll go into that in a second. And so what the final way to get him free was that we had a prisoners exchange. And on December 20th, Alex Saab flew from Miami back to Venezuela. And there he was greeted by his wife, his children, the president's wife, Maduro's wife. It was a beautiful moment. And President Nicolas Maduro made a triumphal public address standing right next to Alex Saab. Now, this was a prisoner exchange, and there were about 10 U.S. prisoners that were exchanged in it. Now, Mr. Biden, he did not make a triumphal address. Particularly, he did not stand with the people who were freed. Now, why didn't he stand with those people that were freed? Well, for one thing, the big ticket item was this guy named Fat Leonard. Probably most of you don't know about Fat Leonard, but he was involved in a corruption scandal that implicated 60 U.S. admirals in the Navy, and they wanted him back really badly. The other people that Biden did not stand along with were two U.S. mercenaries who got it was called on the press the invasion that they had in Venezuela. They tried to assassinate President Maduro. They called the invasion, the press did, the Bay of Piglets. And they, of course, President Biden had no interest in being seen with them at all. So the emancipation of Alex Saab was very similar to the emancipation of the Cuban Five. How many of you have heard of the five Cuban heroes as they've known in Cuba? Yes. And I'm sure many of you worked on that as well. The five Cuban heroes had infiltrated terrorist groups in Miami area, and they were planning attacks on Cuba. So when the Cubans told the United States that there were terrorists in the United States, what the United States did was they arrested the Cuban Five rather than arresting the terrorists, which is par for the course. And that was in 1998, and President Fidel Castro said they would be freed, and they were freed. And in a similar matter, that Al-Assad was freed. There were four elements to the successful campaign of Al-Assad. First was the remarkable resoluteness of Al-Assad. Two was the mobilization of the entire Venezuelan nation in behalf of Al-Assad. Three was the international movement of which we were the part. And four was the strength of his family, and particularly his wife, Camila Fabri de Saab, and William will be telling us more about that. Now, Al-Assad was kind of unique amongst political prisoners because he had what you might say a get-out-of-jail-free card, which he didn't play, and his life was endangered. He was a cancer survivor. He was vomiting blood. He was being tortured. Yet he did not sing, because the United States knew that what Al-Assad was doing was he had circumvented the U.S. sanctions. And because of his actions, food, medicine, and fuel was coming into Venezuela, saving lives. And they knew he had information that could cut off those trade routes. But Al-Assad did not sing. He faced the consequences of death, and he eventually got free. He was a very high-value prisoner for the United States. And the second pillar of the successful campaign to free Al-Assad was the mobilization of the entire Venezuelan nation, from the grassroots all the way up to the top political leadership. The third element was the international campaign. And when I look around the room, there are so many people I know who worked on that campaign. I see Sarah Flounders, who went all the way to Cabo Verde to help free Al-Assad. I was honored to be on part of that international delegation. And there's so many of you that probably I don't know, and that shows how strong that campaign was. Then the fourth pillar of strength of Al-Assad, the one that was really, all four were very important, but was his family, and particularly his wife, Camila Fabri de Saab. She was a young mother, less than 30 years old, with two very young children. She had no political experience, yet out of adversity, she became a political leader in her own right and helped free her husband. And to tell us more about that, I'd like to turn this over to my dear comrade, William Camacaro, from the Alliance for Global Justice. Al-Assad is free.
Yes, I was talking to a friend of ours, Stanfield Smith. And then we were talking for a long time about Alex, and he said to me, asked me, do you think that you can get his lawyer numbers? And he said, well, I think so. Let me make some calls. So I start to make calls. One day I make a bunch of calls, and 2 days later I got a strange call from Venezuela around 12, and I was in a bar, very noisy, and this strange person was asking me, it's true that you want to help Alex Saab? And I was saying, who? Alex Saab? Who is Alex Saab? And then the guy said, okay, bye. And then he said, no, I remember, yes, I want to help Alex Saab. So I went out, and I started to talk to him, and resolved that he was Camila Saab's brother-in-law. And he called me, and I said, well, to start, let's do a webinar with the lawyers. So that was one of the first things that we did, a webinar with some of the lawyers. And then we did, I called first Roger Harris. I called several close people to me at the moment, because it was very strange. I spent, after I got the call, a Greek book looking for information about Alex Saab, and there was no information about him. And the first thing that I did is I went to the website of the foreign minister office in Venezuela, and there was no line about him. So there was nothing about him. And I was thinking, this is very strange. How is it possible that Venezuelan diplomat have been kidnapped 6 months and there is not a single information in any website from the Venezuelan government? And I was very, man, this is rare. Now I understand, because a lot of information has been declassified and people are talking now that basically President Maduro was negotiating at that moment with Trump, and Trump was about to release him. And that's why they didn't make any noise about the fraud case. So we get a bunch of other people involved. And the good thing is that people get, this start to grow by itself, beautiful, around the country, all over. And this is something very important for us, because Alex Saab, at that moment and now, to represent the, it's a hit against the sanctions. It's something that really undermined the power of the sanctions. And for us, was very important to get him out, because Alex Saab, at that time, we're using him as a platform to denounce the sanctions against Venezuela. It wasn't very important for us to do that. And I feel that also that for Venezuelan people was very important, this victory. Was very important for the Venezuelan government that was all the time behind Alex Saab, something that Julian Assange doesn't have. It was very important for the entire movement. I would say, because my time is over, I would say that we should really take care about these important victories that let us know that, yes, we can. We can win. We are able to win, and that's what happened. Thank you.
All right. The next speaker is on the very important case of Simone Trinidad, Ricardo Palmera. We're going to be having Tom Burke, a longtime friend and comrade of mine, up here and talking about the case. And he'll be representing the committee to free Simone Trinidad.
I'm going to speak to you about Simone Trinidad, who's a prisoner of the U.S. Empire. He's a Colombian revolutionary, was a leader in the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia People's Army, the FARC-EP. And I just want to say there's great importance to international solidarity that we're all engaged in. Sometimes, because we're inside the empire, we may feel a little isolated. But I can tell you from traveling to Colombia, about 20 years ago, on the most dangerous trip I've ever been on with Colombian trade unionists from the oil workers' union, that it matters to them. It saves their lives. And what we do here to stop the U.S. war, to stop U.S. intervention, to stop the coup d'etats, to stop the sanctions, makes a big difference over there, and it gives them strength for victory for national liberation struggles. Back in the late 90s, two things were happening in the U.S. One was the U.S. was coming up with what was called Plan Colombia, and a senator named Joe Biden was the main person that introduced Plan Colombia, which was a war plan to the U.S. Senate. It was a plan for misery and death in Colombia. On the other hand, in the middle of this country, there were two comrades. One was Meredith Abbey of the Anti-War Committee and myself in Chicago, who were plotting and planning how to stop this already. And we had the Columbia Action Network to do solidarity work. And one of the best things we came up with was the Coca-Cola boycott, which allowed us to campaign in unions, go to churches and houses of worship. And especially this campaign spread across campuses. Meredith and I were hoping with the Coca-Cola boycott in support of Colombian trade unionists to reach thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people Instead, it took off like a prairie fire, and we were able to reach first hundreds of thousands and then millions of people with our campaign. My union at the time, the SEIU, Service Employees International, had a 5,000-member convention that signed on to the Coca-Cola boycott and opposed, in our wording, Plan Colombia, and said the U.S. should stop funding the war against the FARC and the people of Colombia. So big success. When we organize, we win. So from there, things were developing in Colombia. There were peace negotiations sometimes, but more often there was war against the U.S. and their proxies. You know, the U.S. ran the war in Colombia. Colombian generals were not in charge of the war. It was U.S. generals from Southcom. Someone spoke about that earlier in a workshop. That's who ran the war. That's who gave directions. U.S. intelligence, U.S. weapons. When I stood in front of the largest oil refinery in Colombia with 5,000 workers at 5 in the morning protesting free trade, what did the soldiers wear? They wore U.S. uniforms, and they had Israeli weapons in their hands. That's how this shit works. So we decided that when Simone Trinidad was captured, we needed to do a campaign to free Simone Trinidad. So who is he? He is a Colombian revolutionary who at the age of 37 left the life he knew. He comes from a bourgeois family, from a family that ran jewelry shops, were bankers. He went to the Naval Academy of Colombia's government. He quit a month before he graduated because he decided to take the path of trying to reform the system and organize people. And he did that for years. He joined the Patriotic Union, a political party, which had 4,000-plus members killed by death squads. It was an attempt by the revolutionary movement and reformist groups to unite the left and elect people to power that would change things. But instead, it was attacked by death squads and assassins and never succeeded. When most of his friends that he knew and grew up with were either dead or forced to flee to other countries like Sweden, he decided to go join the FARC at the age of 37. I think that's a pretty amazing thing for someone at that age to go do. And he fought with them for many years. Eventually, he was part of their peace negotiation processes and helped tremendously to advance the negotiations within Colombia to try to get a just and lasting peace. But it wasn't to be. So later, he decided that the FARC needed to negotiate with the UN, and he left and went to Ecuador on his way to meet with Kofi Annan's representatives at the UN when the U.S. and Colombian intelligence captured him, and he was extradited to Washington, D.C. to a jail. This violates the sovereignty of Colombia or any country that has extradition treaties with the U.S. In the case of Alex Saab, there is no extradition treaty, but the U.S. did it anyway. They don't follow any international law. They just make it up as they go. So in Washington, D.C., he was eventually put on trial in a federal courtroom, and we went to that courtroom. Four times he was put on trial, right? The first trial ended in a hung jury, and the judge declared that no one was allowed to talk about the case to outside of the courtroom to have anything to say about it. Well, before the second case began, the defense attorney, who was quite good, had figured out that the judge and the prosecutor had discussed the case because the U.S. prosecutor slipped up. So the judge was forced to step down from those trials because they were caught cheating, trying to prosecute Simone Trinidad and lock him away. And we were there to witness it, and we were there to tell the media about it, and it made big news in Latin America and all around the Caribbean, and especially in Colombia. So we exposed the sham that the U.S. justice system is. That's where the case of the anti-war 23 actually begins. The FBI began investigating us because the judge was angry at us and started coming after us at that point. So after four trials, two on drug charges, two on terrorism charges, Simone Trinidad was found guilty of one charge related to, a big surprise, being a member of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which apparently is a crime in the U.S. courtrooms. So the judge gave him a 70-year sentence. They enhanced everything. He's at the peace negotiations with a rifle on his shoulder. That enhances the charges by 7 years. So they just throw everything onto it. So now he's a prisoner in the Florence, Colorado Supermax. That's a torture prison for anyone who's inside of it. There is no fresh air. It's only solitary confinement, the type where you don't even get to interact with the guards, right? Everything's done remotely, and you're by yourself the whole time. But through our struggle and through supporting him and through the peace process that happened in Colombia, he now has relative freedom in the prison. He can get books and reading materials. He can have conversations with some select other prisoners. And he gets to see his lawyer, Mark Burton, regularly. So where we're at today is things have changed a lot in Colombia. The peace process was not all that good for the FARC. They've splintered into 2.5 other armed groups. Their political groups that came out splintered into now 3 different parties. It's hard and difficult for us to find someone in Colombia to campaign to free Simone Trinidad. He was not included in the peace negotiations and set free, which would have been the time to do it. But we're still campaigning for him. We still stand with him. There's a mass movement that's emerged in Colombia that is very repressed, violently repressed still. They're still killing people every week. There's over 400 former FARC combatants who have been murdered by death squads. But people persist and are struggling and advancing the mass movement there. It's resulted in the election of a leftist president who's named Petro, and he is key for us going forward. We need to get President Petro to demand the freedom of Simone Trinidad so we can join him and build a movement here to force Biden to free Simone Trinidad. Thank you for your time. Solidarity.
Thank you very much, Tom, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this important case in the future. So at this point, we're going to hear some words about Julian Assange. We're going to have Colleen Raleigh, I believe, a very, very well-known person, FBI whistleblower. She's going to be talking for the Twin Cities Assange defense. Come up here. Give it up for Colleen. It's good to see you up here.
I guess I should update Assange case right now for people who don't know, although he's become such an iconic, almost an iconic, I hate to say the word, but he's an iconic martyr right at this point, because they are absolutely intent on martyring him, whether he's convicted or not. He's not convicted of anything. They've held him one way or the other for like 12 years now. 12 years. And that would actually take the life out of most people. And it is having, you know, he's in Belmarsh, which is a really bad, torturous prison. And it's running a toll on him. He's had a stroke already. And so it's not good at all. But he's still hanging in there. And there are people fighting for him, including the same things that you just mentioned for other people. His wife, his family, I mean, the international groups. The journalists, a lot of important. The thing that he has going for him is, you know what? This turns out to be freedom of press. So actually, even the New York Times and the Guardian and El Mundo and the major newspapers of the world they almost have to say they want him free. They have to say that. But unfortunately, they think they're in the club. You know, you guys were calling it, people called it the establishment. They call it, what was the other terms for Washington, D.C. these days? The ruling class. Okay, I think the better name for this is the blob. The blob. I like that better. But that blob, which actually is headquartered in Washington, D.C., maybe a little bit in Israel, too, and some in NATO, but that blob, in times of war, so, you know, when we're not in a war, when we're kind of in a lull before this last perpetual war, we forget, you know, we think we have freedom of assembly, here we are, we're kind of taking that for granted, freedom of association. All those years, at least I'm going to be 70, and all those years after Vietnam, I think we took it for granted that there was some freedom of speech and freedom of press. The newspapers for sure thought that you could publish the Pentagon Papers. Why did they think that you could do that without having the government stop you, as they did with WikiLeaks and other groups? Why did they think that? Because there's a Supreme Court case. They took that to the Supreme Court and they won. But guess what? That's over now. That's over now. That, you know, what people have said. Not only international law, the Vienna Conventions, the Geneva Conventions, all of the international law that I studied, not only is that over, but our domestic law is over too. And the main pillar for our ability to unite, we talked about uniting, building movements. The main pillar of that is the First Amendment, freedom of speech, press, and association. When that goes up in smoke, as they are attempting to do, and they're attempting to do that by martyring Julian Assange, and also by complete censorship. People mentioned the word disinformation. Okay, there is a disinformation complex right now. And it's a big business. They're going to give college degrees for disinformation. And the funny thing is, if your Democrats are in power, then certain things are disinformation, you know, whatever. If you're Republicans, wait a minute, I'll just give an example. When the Democrats were in power, the big disinformation was Russiagate. Okay, so Russiagate was all a hoax. But we had to listen to Rachel Maddow every night talking about this. These were all lies. So disinformation by the blob is they can come up with anything. They can say anything is untrue. And this is in times of war. We have the Espionage Act from 1917 when Woodrow Wilson decided he was going to go to war, and Debs and others were all against it. He had to turn all of his supporters, who he had promised peace to, into warmongers. And he did that by passing the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, and they started putting all of the people that were against war into jail. It is happening again. It happened during Vietnam again. It reared its ugly head. That's why we had Daniel Ellsberg. I will just say one other thing here, which is that if we want the truth, remember what Julian Assange, his famous quote is, if lies can start wars, then the truth should be able to end them. The Pentagon Papers did a fair job, actually, of ending the Vietnam War. It played a role in that. And that was the whole theory. But now with the disinformation complex, they have to manipulate your minds. And they do that through censorship of the truth. How many reporters have watched 11, 12 years of what happened to Julian Assange and say, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to write about the truth of this matter? Well, you're going to be, first of all, you'll be fired in a New York second. I and another Minnesotan are going to go on the Gaza flotilla here. And, you know, you know what? It's not only scary, whatever, but one would think it could be newsworthy, right? We were told already we weren't told directly, but indirectly by our major newspaper here, it's not newsworthy. And why is it not newsworthy? It's because of this repression and disinformation that we're living in. So whistleblowers, and Daniel Ellsberg was a great example, there is no ability to get the truth out if you go to the press and they say, no, we don't want to know. They put their hands over their ears. We won't publish that. It's not newsworthy. Actually, Daniel Ellsberg had that experience. He went for like a year or two, and he had the papers right with him, and nobody would publish them for a while. So that's the kind of situation we're in, and we need more people. I'm going to end on a more positive note. This has become a millstone around Biden. Biden knows that they do not have a legal leg to stand on to imprison a publisher, okay? And also, our whole democracy goes up in smoke. Our rule of law, everything. Everything depends on the First Amendment. Our ability to share information. Everything ends if we don't have the First Amendment. That was the Thomas Jefferson knew that. And Biden knows, so that what he's trying to do is push it to the election. And hoping, of course, that maybe, you know, Assange might stroke out or something. But they're trying to push this off. And this is why, for all the activism that we can do, it is a time when we can have an impact. I still think that, maybe there's some decent person left in government. And if we could fall on that person, if we could get more whistleblowers, if we could get the press, by the way, if we could even get the ACLU, who is keeping quiet about this because they're part of this whole repression too. So anyway, we need to do more, and at the very least, remember what's at stake. It's about our ability to even have a conference.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode was Plenary 4 from the 2024 UNAC Conference, held April 5th through the 7th in St. Paul, Minnesota. The plenary is entitled, Defending Our Movement, Confronting Repression. UNAC is the United National Anti-War Coalition. UNAC fights against wars at home and abroad. Their goal is to bring together organizations and movements representing people in struggle today and unify in collective action against the major perpetrator of war and injustice in the world, the United States government, along with its allies and proxies. You can download this audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net. Thanks for listening.